Iranians fill the streets across the country to mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Addressing the rallies in Tehran, President Raisi says enemies have failed in their hybrid war against Iran due to the nation's resistance. And the death toll from Monday's massive earthquakes that rocked Syria and Turkey tops 24,000, but rescue teams are still pulling people out alive. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iranians have thronged the streets across the nation to mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. People from all walks of life are out on the streets to celebrate the occasion and renew allegiance to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. They are carrying banners and chanting slogans in support of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. People rose up against the corrupt Pahlavi regime in the 1970s. Their struggles culminated in the toppling of the Pahlavi tyrannical rule and the triumph of the Islamic Revolution on the 11th of February, 1979. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. Raisi made the remark in an address to the rally in the capital, Tehran, marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He hailed the nation for its resoluteness in the face of Western pressure, noting that the U.S. and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The president also touched on recent riots in Iran, saying the enemies decided to create chaos by waging a hybrid and psychological war, but to no avail. Raisi underlined that the Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. He said that the West, the U.S. in particular, stand accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. He added that the West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region. Political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshcheshme says Iran has made significant progress in the post-Islamic Revolution era despite crippling Western sanctions.
That Iran is making progress despite sanctions, this is true. The country has been under the toughest sanctions ever imposed on any nation for all the past 43 years. The Americans started developing regulations, sanctions regulations, as well as the economic and global economic centers they needed in order to impose these sanctions. They have developed four layers of sanctions against Iran. One is the nuclear layer, the other one missile program, the other one for Iran's regional power. The fourth one, which is half through, it's not been built yet, it's the human rights.
Right.
So bringing about and approving and ratifying new kinds of soft sanctions that would not even tickle the Islamic Republic. They do it for propaganda, first, but second, it sets the stage for foreign currency meddling inside Iran. They have developed a formula in order to do that through psychological warfare and media propaganda. Now, these are only two or three areas of this hybrid warfare. This hybrid warfare also includes cyber warfare, media warfare, terror and assassination, sabotage attacks, diplomatic and political pressuring, giving credit to military threats, and so many other areas. In many of these areas, not only the Islamic Republic has defended pretty well and defused their attacks and offensives, but also it has launched a counterattack, very successful one.
Lebanese journalist Sundus Al-Assad joined us earlier with her take on the impact of the Islamic Revolution on the world.
It's the revolution of the oppressed against all kind of global arrogance. It's the revolution of the oppressed against tyranny, against hegemony, against imperialism, against Zionism. that's why they all the time these conspiracies that are launched against this revolution, because it's the revolution that empowers those deprived people, those weak people. What the resistance in Lebanon has reached today, it's thanks for the Islamic Revolution. This revolution that represents every free nation across the globe. It hasn't only inspired the Lebanese, it hasn't only inspired the Muslim peoples, but also in the Latin America and Africa. We all see the impact of this revolution on those people.
People all the way in the Russian capital of Moscow are commemorating the 44th anniversary of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Many are seeking to dive deeper into the history of the uprising, which managed to put an end to years of Western interference in Iran.
More than 1,700 guests attended the National Day reception in the center of Moscow, hosted by the Iranian embassy, to mark the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The reception was attended by top Russian dignitaries, as well as military figures and members of the civil society. Non-Russian diplomats could also be seen at the event.
Basing on objective analysis, I am absolutely sure that now our Russian people with Iranian people should fight together against the great enemy, our common enemy, understanding together each other better and better, as well on the spiritual level.
The prominent philosopher says he predicted that modern Iran and Russia would grow closer years ago. They share the same values, interests, and both belong to the ancient Eurasian civilization. They also seek to bring an end to years of Western dominance and oppression across the globe.
Iran is truly one of a kind in this world. It has one of the most ancient civilizations, and it continues to live up to that legacy. Despite heavy sanctions and pressure, they have made astonishing achievements in the past four decades. People are high-spirited. Iranians yearn for development. I'm very glad that the relations between Iran and Russia are flourishing. Together we can solve many problems in West Asia and around the world.
According to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, in the last year alone, trade with Iran and Russia has reached $5 billion. The position of the two countries is in tune with a number of international agendas. The two nations oppose the model of a unipolar device and will do everything to defend their sovereignty.
Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic Revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A Pakistani Shia cleric has been detained in Saudi Arabia while he was on the Umrah pilgrimage in Mecca. Allama Nazir Abbas Taqvi's arrest has been shared on his official Twitter account. He can be seen standing at Islam's holiest site with a flag showing the name of the first Shia imam. He remains in the Saudi captivity days after performing the Umrah. Taqvi is a secretary of the Shia Ummah Council, a religio-political organization in Pakistan. The social media post has not cited any specific reason behind his detention, but his holding the flag could be the reason, since the al-Saud regime does not respect religious freedom and cracks down on those who do not adhere to the kingdom's interpretation of Islam. 5 days after a deadly and devastating earthquake hit the Turkish and Syrian regions, rescuers are racing against time to pull out any survivors from the debris. This is the moment when a man was rescued in Turkey after spending more than 104 hours under the rubble. he can be heard reciting the Holy Quran. Another group of rescuers pulled out a woman alive in the Turkish province of Hatay. Across the border, rescuers also found a 6-year-old boy alive under the wreckage in Syria's northwestern region. A Syrian mother and her 10-day-old baby were also found alive. The rescue operations, however, have been hampered by freezing weather and the lack of equipment. The death toll from the powerful earthquake continues to rise and currently stands at over 24,000. Based on official figures, over 3,500 people have been confirmed dead in Syria, while more than 20,665 people have died in Turkey so far. The Turkish president has visited the front lines of the disaster. He admitted that rescue efforts were very difficult due to the scale of the devastation.
Despite the fact that we have gathered perhaps one of the largest search and rescue teams to the region, with more than 140,000 members, unfortunately it's a fact that we have not been able to respond as fast as we hoped.
Erdogan further added that his government would help people move from tents to houses and give them financial assistance for rent. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad and his wife also visited the quake-hit areas in the northwestern city of Aleppo. Assad stopped by the Aleppo University Hospital where the injured people are being treated. The Syrian president also inspected relief efforts while pledging more support. Early on Monday morning, southern Turkey and northern Syria were hit by a 7.8 magnitude quake that was followed by hundreds of aftershocks. Moving on to the U.S., the FBI has discovered an additional classified document during a search at a residence of former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. The investigators found the one-page document in Pence's Indianapolis house. Last month, the ex-vice president said his lawyers had discovered dozens of documents marked classified at his home. They were turned over to authorities. The developments put Pence in the company of President Joe Biden and his predecessor Donald Trump. They are both facing investigations for improper handling of classified material. Meanwhile, the U.S. says it has shot down a high-altitude object over Alaska on the order of President Joe Biden. The White House says the unidentified object was traveling at about 40,000 feet when it was intercepted by a fighter jet. National Security spokesman John Kirby says it is not clear where the object came from. According to Kirby, it landed in the U.S. waters and authorities expect to recover it. The Pentagon has also described the object as unmanned, adding that it was not maneuverable. That is a careful distinction with a high-altitude Chinese balloon the U.S. shot down on February the 4th. The balloon incident has triggered tensions between Beijing and the U.S., which has slammed the U.S. move as an overreaction. Also, the U.S. says it has blacklisted 6 Chinese entities connected to what it calls Beijing's surveillance balloon program. The U.S. Commerce Department says 5 companies and 1 research institute are targeted with export restrictions. The department says they support China's military modernization efforts. The measures come after the U.S. shot down what it called a Chinese spy balloon a week ago. Washington says the manufacturer is in direct relationship with the People's Liberation Army of China. Beijing has rejected this, saying that the object was a meteorological apparatus that accidentally entered U.S. territory. The Peruvian president is calling for a multi-party dialogue to take the country out of its political crisis. Now, that is amid persisting anti-government protests. Dina Boluarte says Peru is now the most fragile democracy in Latin America. She is repeating her demand for snap elections after it was twice rejected by Congress. Peru has been the scene of violent anti-government demonstrations since early December that have left nearly 50 people dead. The protests began after the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo for his attempts to dissolve Congress. The protesters are also demanding Castillo's release. They also want the incumbent Boluarte to resign and to hold early elections. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky raises eyebrows by demanding his country is granted almost immediate membership of the European Union. Turkey has been in the process of joining the 27-nation bloc for almost two decades. Jerome Hughes reports.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed. And it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support. And we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict. There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine. But there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes at the European Council, Brussels.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
A museum to wonder and reflect, a prison for torture and control, and a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other, but it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. In this week's documentary, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time. the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Ghash edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after more than decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
...1979, Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the glass prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the glass prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass prison. Over the last two centuries, the building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Ghasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the centre of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurram Abad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure: a large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fath Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena, Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, the palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion. In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasser ad-Din Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the Ghass prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were 2 underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the 2 canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined. An idiom with a pleasant literal meaning, but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
و درونزای جامعه ایران با اخلال روبرو بشه.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in SAVAK, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years.
Safarkhan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband." Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently. It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As-Saadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Saadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way.
But from the year 1951,
But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودند حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad, and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused, and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
This is For a Better Life for IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. And today I want to talk about a new theme, which is the topic of fear. I need to repeat that whatever I say is based on the Quran and Islamic narrations. Fear can be uncomfortable and crippling. But since Allah never creates anything in our body without a purpose, we need to realize firstly why fear is created in our body. The fact is that if people didn't feel fear, they wouldn't become fearful. They wouldn't be able to protect themselves from surrounding threats and dangers. Fear is a vital response to physical and emotional danger. Because of this, even though research shows that babies do not appear to show signs of fear until around 8 or maybe 12 months of age, usually in response to new people or new events, they do not show any form of fear. But when they become a little older and their brain starts to function more, we see many sources of fear appear in their behavior. A common of this fear is when a stranger hugs them and the baby quickly starts crying and being scared. What is important in the process of the existence of fear in children, you should pay attention to this point, is that no one has taught the children to be afraid. And this shows that the feeling of fear was placed in the form of instinct and it was created by Allah. And another interesting point is that such fear is seen in all children. And we know that something that exists in all humans, regardless of their color and race, is due to the God-given instinct in humans. And fear is just like hunger, thirst, and other sorts of feelings. So far, we have realized that fear is a part of our creation, and it can never be completely removed. If there were no fear, and if there were not for the blessing of fear, we might do any dangerous things, like driving at high speed when we are in a car, not being afraid of falling off a cliff, for example, not protecting ourselves from being ill because we are not afraid of disease, or do not run away from seeing a wild and dangerous animal, or even wouldn't be afraid of committing suicide.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We also can add other kinds of fear that I call it a divine fear, like being afraid of divine punishment, that it persuades us not to commit sins. And this divine fear helps us to be more obedient to Allah. This is the kind of fear that possesses a pivotal role in being pious, being a good worshiper, and a good servant to Allah. Of course, it needs its own description, and its boundaries should be clarified. I mean, the fear of Allah. I am going to focus on a kind of physical and emotional fear that is related to our daily life or daily life on this world, and to say how putting it into our control can be resultant in having and enjoying a better life. It is a part of our creation that we cannot eliminate it entirely, even though we are able to reduce it or to overcome it if it causes some abnormal negative impact on our life. However, there is another kind of fear that can hold us back in our life. Some feelings that are commonly described as fears are in reality mental obstacles that they limit people's actions and reduces people's ability to decide. These fears often prevent people from making progress, such as the fear of failure, the fear of not achieving a kind of success, the fear of rejection, of missing out, or even commitment. These feelings of insecurity or unworthiness or maybe indecision can often be addressed in therapy and should be treated. Let's refer to what the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, says about this negative fear. The Imam says, وَالْجُبْنُ مَنْقَصَهُ. The fear and dread is a defect. We also can sense that if a man is not courageous, cannot take legitimate and normal risks, he is often afraid of some ordinary things that it is not normal to be afraid of in ordinary and normal situations. Such a man, we can sense that he may face a kind of deficiency in his life, and this kind of fear makes him totally dysfunctional. Let's go for a short break, and I will be back shortly and describe this point more. Cowardly people, fearful people, can never use their abilities, cannot use their competence and talents, and the result of this negative fear is backwardness in life, causes many drawbacks. In addition, with their religion, life, honor, and even their country are in danger, when these people are afflicted with the negative fear, they refrain from protecting them, and instead of being in the ranks of brave defenders, they stand in the ranks of the disabled, sick people who remain motionless and totally unable. No coward has ever reached the position he has not made an important discovery, nor has he achieved a remarkable victory, nor, for example, has he reached the highest of perfection. For this matter, Imam Ali advises Malik Ashtad, his well-known companion, never to let cowardly people into the cycle of his advisors, and says, وَلَا تُدْخِلَنَّ فِي مَشْفَرَتِكَ بَخِيلًا وَلَا جَبَانًا. The word jaban here means someone who is usually fearful and coward. One of the most important causes of this type of fear is not to have a good suspicion about Allah. The outcome of trusting Allah is that if we know that God has promised the believers that He is with them and will not let them alone, the individual would not be that much fearful. The fact is that Allah advises people in many verses of the Quran to get to the battles of problems and ask for help from Him. For example, when Allah dispatches Moses and his brother Harun to Pharaoh, Moses and Harun said to Allah, إِنَّنَا نَخَافُ أَن يَفْرُطَ عَلَيْنَا أَوْ أَن يَطْغَى. We strongly are afraid that Pharaoh transgresses against us or become a more rioter. But Allah responds, لا تخافا, do not be fearful, إنني معكما أسمع وأرى. I am with you and see and hear everything. Surely the fear of Moses and Harun was not a negative fear, but this verse tells us that having good faith in Allah is one of the factors to overcome fear. Inshallah, I will talk about this subject more in this series of the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
every grain of sand in every desert land. He knows every shade of palm, every closed hand. He knows every sparkling tear on every eyelash. He knows every thought I have and every word I share. He knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.